Join with me this morning in 1 Kings chapter 12. We'll read verses 25 through 33. 1 Kings 12, 25 through 33. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. Also he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah." Therefore the king asked advice, made two calves of gold, and said to the people, "It is too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt." And he set up one in Bethel, and he put the other in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. He made shrines on the high places and made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day in the 8th month, like a feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves he had made. And at Bethel he installed priests in the high places which he had made. So he made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day in the 8th month, in the month of which he had devised in his own heart. He ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar of burnt incense. Brother Drew.
You might have come across a book series. I would find myself anytime used to walk into a bookstore, go into Barnes & Noble, anywhere like that, would usually just sort of set up shop in the history section and browse through those. If you are like that, you might have seen a series called A Dark History. It's a series of books. It would look at a dark history of the popes or a dark history of the kings of England or something of that nature. And that title, I think, has somewhat of a double meaning. It was a history oftentimes of something that was maybe often unknown, or history that had not been covered very much, sort of lived in the dark corners, but also usually had reference to something very bad. It was going to tell you all the sordid tales of whatever the subject of the book was, all of the violence and mayhem and all of the really, really bad things that people try to keep from coming to light as they would look at a dark history. When we look at the nation of Israel, it is, in that second sense, certainly a dark history. It is almost unanimously, almost unrelentingly negative, violent, sinful, foolish, totally godless. But as far as being hidden or not covered very well, that would not be the case at all. Their primary problem was very plain. It was very well known. It is, in fact, a matter of sterling scriptural record because God pays so much attention to it throughout the rest of his communication with that nation. The primary problem was, as we have alluded to before and as our reading spelled out for us from 1 Kings chapter 12, those kings of the north, the kings of the northern nation of Israel, when the tribes split and divided, the 10 in the north were under the leadership of King Jeroboam the First, and they continually struggled with one thing. In fact, they struggled with a sin that became known roughly by his name, as we will see in a moment. The sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin. I want to learn a bit about sin through this long, dark history that we find in the northern nation of Israel. I'm not so much interested in exactly what it was that Jeroboam did wrong. We saw that in 1 Kings chapter 12. That's sort of a miniature sermon of its own that's very easy to adapt into 4 or 5 points. where you see everything that Jeroboam did in changing the worship. He made graven images, which he was not supposed to make. He made high places, which he was not supposed to make. He changed the location instead of having the people go to Jerusalem as they were intended to do. He had the people serving as priests who were not of the tribe of Levi, as they were not supposed to do. He really changes every facet of the worship that people were meant to offer to Jehovah alone in the way that he had prescribed. But, again, this morning, I'm not so interested in what he changed. I want to look at the fallout and what this teaches us about the same thing that might happen when we digress, when we move away from our God and no longer do as he wants us to do. The effects of sin will ultimately, in many ways, be exactly the same for us. We can learn quite a bit about our God, our relationship to him, and how that can be imperiled by looking at what happens with the sin of Israel. First of all, let's be very clear. I mentioned a moment ago that this is a matter of record, of indisputable record, as the scriptures continue after 1 Kings chapter 12. This is the anchor point that the Lord returns to time and time again when he is describing the wickedness of this people. Jeroboam starts it, but the men who came after him continued it. In fact, his immediate successor, Nadab, did. You read about that in 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 26. And then Baasha continues that. Baasha had everyone in the house of Jeroboam murdered. Everyone who is a part of the family that had begun that worship of the golden calves, he has each one of them killed, and yet he continues with that sin. And Zimri murders Baasha and becomes king in his place, and he follows in the same sin. And Omri does so. And it was taken even further by Ahab, who is the worst yet. He's described as being more sinful than any who had come before him. And then his son, Ahaziah. And then Jehoram, who at least had the sense to put away other idols, but he still hung on to Jeroboam's sin. And even Jehu, the only thing approaching a good king in Israel's history. He hated idolatry. He hated Baal, but he didn't turn away from this sin. 2 Kings 10 and verse 31 makes that point, that bitter point the Lord must say of him. He did many things with zeal for me, but he didn't put away the sin of Jeroboam. And Jehoahaz, his son, and Jehoash, his grandson, and Jeroboam the second, his great-grandson, and then Zechariah, the fourth of that dynasty of Jehu, he follows in the same sin. And then Menahem, who had killed another usurper, Shallum, after only a month of his reign, and then Pekahiah, and then Pekah. You get these list of names, and you say, well, I don't know a lot about these men. They've got one thing in common that's very plain. Each one of them, it is said in the scriptural record, he followed in the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin. During this time in Israel's history, they had 19 kings. 19 men led them as their monarch in this period after the kingdom split following the reign of Solomon. Only three of those men, Elah and Shallum and Hoshea, are not specifically mentioned as having followed the sin of Jeroboam. And of course, you read about those men, they were no sterling godly men themselves. Elah was simply an idolater. Shallum really didn't have time to do anything very wicked because he only lasted for a month during a turbulent period. Hoshea is simply described in 2 Kings 17 as being evil, apparently not of the same order, maybe a lesser order than the men who came before him. But as the last king of Israel, he oversees its downfall into captivity and destruction. One man, Jeroboam, begins this terrible trend. He began his reign, so far as we can tell, we'll ballpark it at about 930 BC. That last man that we mentioned, Hoshea, was carried away captive in about 720 BC. You have over 200 years of history passing. Really, the entire history of that nation. If we look at our nation, it's kind of similar. We're a little bit more than 200, but not so very much. If we were to say something had been going on since 1776, something had been going on since the founding of our nation, we would be saying it's the whole time that we have been a nation. It's the whole time that we have been a distinct people. And that is the case with Israel in this sin. 200 years of folly come from one disastrous change in policy. One sin that sets the chain in motion. When the Lord is giving his summary of Israel's downfall, you get in 2 Kings 17, maybe keep your finger in that passage if you have a ribbon in your Bible. Mine is falling out. This is my Bible. I've bragged to you about how crummy it is, how bad shape it is. That's one of its fun features. The ribbon doesn't stay in place, so I have to rig it with a pin holding it. But at any rate, if you have a ribbon in your Bible, maybe put it in 2 Kings 17, because this passage is really the Lord giving the eulogy for Israel. Eulogy is a bad term. Eulogy means kind of a good word that is spoken, that we like to speak at someone's funeral. This is not a eulogy. This is a malogy, I guess we would say. It's a very bad thing that God says. But he is reading the record of Israel, this northern nation, and just recounting all of the sin and all of the foolishness that they continued to fall into. But look at verse 22. Well, start in verse 21. God tore Israel from the house of David. They made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. Then Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them commit a great sin. For the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he has said by all his servants, the prophets. They started going in that direction, and they did not stop. That lasted. It persisted after one man made that decision. In fact, we could spot a trend that they only grew worse and worse as time went on. Can we see the impact that this can have? Can we see the impact that sin can have on our families, on our churches, in our society? Once we have given up ground to sin, once we have given up ground to worldliness or compromise or any departure from God and love for God and reverence for God, it is very difficult in practice. Historically, it is almost impossible, actually, to claim that ground back for godliness and a love for the Lord after it has been given up. It is very, very rare. It happens, but it is the rarity that the pendulum swings back to the Lord, back to a love for his ways, back to a zeal for things which are spiritual and right and godly. It is much more likely that once the trend away from him begins, it picks up steam. Do you want to be responsible for leading others in generations that you will never see, that you will never know, but the reason for their lack of faith might be traced back to you in the decisions that you have made to sin against God, to depart from him? One of my good friends, was a good friend for a long time, has departed the faith within the last several years, once said to another good friend of ours that really that would be an impossibility, that he would never do that because he has young children, several young children. He said, if for no other reason, I would hate to do something that would result in my children being lost. If I were to weaken, if I were to grow faint, if I were to go do something that I should not be doing, I would be exponentially increasing the chances that my children are going to follow in those same footsteps. He recognized the truth of what we see playing out in Israel's history, that sin doesn't stop with me. Still, we would not want to sin against God, but especially maybe the more noble-minded of us would say, well, if I do something and it harms me, that's okay. But I wouldn't want to do anything that hurts somebody else. If you sin against God, you're absolutely doing something that will harm someone else. And probably the people that you love the most, that you hold most dear in this life. Do we see the long-lasting impact that sin can have? The consequences that that evil can bring about? It begins a disastrous trend. Somewhat in line with this, recognize that what God sees as evil does not tend to change with the times, does not tend to shift depending on the whim of those in power, those who are kind of the tastemakers for society, are not the ones who get to determine what God approves of or finds abhorrent. Surely some of those later kings of Israel didn't really see anything wrong with those worship centers at Dan and Bethel and offering sacrifices to golden calves and having a mixed tribe priesthood where if you were from Zebulun, you could be a priest, sure, and whoever else wanted to, that's fine as well. These graven images that they erected and said, this is Jehovah. I would be certain that after 200 years of that being part of their state worship and the culture that they saw all around them, it would really be unthinkable to them that they had gotten that wrong, that this was anything that God wouldn't be pleased with. They were part of long-standing practice by that time. They were encouraged in that tradition by their citizens, their families, their advisors. It was totally normalized by the days of a Zechariah or a Jeroboam II. But interestingly enough, the Bible does not really make much commentary about the culture of the land, except to sometimes point out that the people had grown very wicked. Why do you think that is? That God doesn't tell us a lot about what their particular beliefs were? Because it doesn't matter what the society or the culture was like. If it was sinful, it was sinful. If God had told the people not to do it, it didn't matter how many hundreds of years passed in between the commandment and their time, God did not want them to do it. This is easy to see the parallel to our current situation. Some things are increasing in acceptance, are being normalized as we look at our culture socially. I don't need to read a laundry list of statistics. You've seen the numbers on adultery and divorce and the carnage that wreaks in homes and just how lightly those things are treated in our society. That is a sea change from what would have been the norm 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. An increasingly, I used the word exponential a moment ago. It just continues to grow more and more rapidly in that direction where those things are acceptable. The practice of homosexuality would be put in the same category. Something that is increasingly just being looked at as, it's just, there really isn't anything wrong with that anymore. We're more enlightened now. We understand now that that is something that no one should have a problem with. The anger that men feel and show to each other in so many different ways. There is maybe it's just because everything is so visible these days. If you go anywhere and see anything weird happening, what do you see 5 feet behind the weird thing happening? A guy with his camera out recording it. And maybe that's what gives the rise in the impression, at least, that these sort of things are becoming more prevalent. But this year, I have seen more videos of fights in football stadiums and baseball stadiums than I can remember seeing in my entire life. It seems like a week doesn't pass without some drunken fools getting into a huge brawl in the bleachers of a stadium or in an airport or wherever it might be, that people are just at each other's throats all the time. And again, this is just sort of becoming normal behavior. Well, if someone disrespects you, you can't let that pass. You got to throw one back at them. This is just sort of the culture that we've created for ourselves. These things are becoming normal. Is God fine with them now? Because, well, about 80% of people think that this is okay. So, yeah, go get drunk at a football game and throw a few haymakers because everyone else is doing it. We recognize the foolishness of that argument. That won't stand up. Of course, even within the church, we see practices that would not have been found years ago, would not have been found in the primitive church. We say, well, times change, culture changes. Maybe God approves of things now that he once didn't. How is the church organized? How does the church worship? Are things accepted by God because they are accepted by us? Or when we have that attitude, are we simply following the sin of Jeroboam? Saying, this is what my people have done. This is what we've decided is the right thing to do now. In our reading a moment ago from 1 Kings chapter 12, you may have noticed a phrase Jeroboam said to himself. In fact, if you look at that phrase throughout the books of Samuel and Kings especially, it's almost always, I won't say always, but it's usually a sign that something really dumb is about to happen. It's usually a sign that somebody's about to do something he really doesn't have any business doing. And I think a lot of that is the same way today. I say to myself, well, why not be more interested in what God has already said? This is where Israel falls. They depart. It doesn't matter what culture says. Observe from this long, dark history as well that sin really has no preferences. Sin makes no distinction in who is endangered by it and in who is actually called wicked when they follow that sin. I won't make too much of this because we don't know much information about many of those kings of Israel, but just a cursory reading of those 19 men and their lives reveals that they were a varied bunch. Some of them were very capable and industrious. They were skilled as leaders and administrators, and they built up strong militaries, and they instigated changes to the way that the country was run and to the infrastructure that was found there in Israel. And the rest of history, in fact, acknowledges some of those men as being very powerful and being capable in their day. Some of them were not like that at all. They were murderous and wild and foolish. You get that picture of Zimri, who was king for just a little while, decides to commit suicide by burning the house down on himself when he realized that his time as king was up. This is a crazy man who is willing to go to that extreme in order to end his life on his own terms. Some of them followed in other sins, like child sacrifice, the worship of completely foreign gods, pagan deities. Some of them really showed at least a token respect to many of God's ways and many of God's instructions. Some of them started some incomplete reforms and then just fell off along the way. The point in all of that is simply this. Regardless of their tribe, their age, their experience, their material success, their overall morality or wickedness, their popularity, their physical appearance, their potential, the length of their reign, any other factor that we seem to weigh when we are evaluating a man, when they committed the same sin, it was considered to be the same sin. I followed the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, but I was a pretty good guy otherwise. Well, it was okay for you then. I followed the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and I passed my children through the fire. Well, then you were a bad one, obviously. God isn't making a distinction between these two hypothetical parties. If they sinned, they were wicked. Do we see evil this way? Do we see the danger of wickedness against God in this way? That there is not that mitigating factor. We can't pass something off as unimportant because we are otherwise good people, or because I also do a lot of good things, or because this is my family member and I just love them and I can't really judge them for doing this. If it's a sin, it's a sin, and I don't have any business doing it. It really is that simple. Recognize from one special episode, in fact, during this time period. Good men can be corrupted by sin's influence. We've mentioned these 19 men who were a pretty rough crew in the north. Meanwhile, their brethren to the south in the kingdom of Judah, they had their bad apples too, especially towards the end of things. But they also had many men who were godly. Sort of the opposite number to saying that they followed the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Oftentimes of these men in Judah, we'll see they followed the ways of their father David. And they didn't depart from them to the right or to the left. They were godly. They loved the Lord. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. One of the very, very best of those men in the southern kingdom was Jehoshaphat. We looked at his life some months ago in a sermon and found at the time what seems to be his one, possibly his only, major flaw that he is twice rebuked for, which is his insistence on affiliating himself with kings of Israel. He makes many reforms. He tries his level best to get the people of Judah to follow the Lord. He, however, seems to have this soft spot for his cousins up there in the north. He makes alliances with Ahab in 2 Chronicles chapter 19. Chapter 20 tells us he makes an alliance with Ahab's son, Ahaziah. Both of those instances, really as soon as that has happened, where Jehoshaphat says, let's go together, let's go do something together, go to war together, go on a business venture, make some money together, whatever it is, it's not very long at all before a prophet of the Lord shows up and says, what are you doing? What are you doing with these guys? Don't you know what's going on up there in the north? Do you want to have anything to do with that? Get back away from that and keep doing what you have been doing, which God is pleased with. I am encouraging us to be careful and to be aware. I recognize, and well, we can't help but recognize it, as the Lord himself would tell us, you can't go out of the world. You can't remove yourselves from the world. And I don't think that God wants us to do that, even if it were possible. We are not to completely cut ourselves off from the world, from those who are around us. We simply can't do that. Just try to identify everyone in the world who practices sin and never have anything to do with them. How would anyone be saved? How would anyone come to knowledge of God if we didn't have some influence upon the world? But we need to be sure that the influence is moving in that direction and that we are cautious. We can grow so closely entwined with those who practice evil that they begin to exert their influence upon us. Becoming friends with the world is the way the Lord describes it. Even the very best. Again, Jehoshaphat, if we read the record of him, we're impressed. He's good. He did far better than almost everyone who was a colleague of his. And yet even him, when he is around those who can pull him down, the Lord tells him, you need to tread carefully. You need to get rid of this influence from your life. Because the Lord knows what we often fail to recognize. Sin is very powerful in this way. It's like a weed wraps itself around those healthy roots and then just squeezes and strangles and spreads that death and loss and ruin wherever it goes. We would be wise not to be too friendly with it. Well, here's the bad news. We've talked about the devastating power that sin has and the things that we need to be guarded against. Its corrosive influence, its ability to harm any one of us, regardless of any background, regardless of who you might be, what you are doing elsewhere in your life, sin is sin. Regardless of what our society tells us is right and the model that culture has made for us. And once we begin down that road, it is very difficult to shake free of that. And it will certainly be difficult for later generations to shake free. And yet, all is not lost, or all does not need to be lost with those who find themselves entangled in such a way. We'll look at the end for Israel in just a moment. Before we do, I'm going to ask Dylan to lead us in this song that is telling us the view we are meant to have of our God. This song, The Highest Place. Israel made their high places. They made many overtures to gods who were not God. There was one that they were meant to call upon as Lord. Let's sing this song together right now. What is the good news for those who would put the Lord in his proper place, respective to us? Who would place him in that highest place? Who would come and offer sincere worship to him? The good news for those is that God always presents an alternative to sin. Even with this persistent folly, a continual, every single generation repeating the same mistake, madness that took hold of Israel for 200 years, even within that, God was still trying, even until the very end. 2 Kings chapter 17, beginning in verse 13, tells us that the Lord testified against Israel and against Judah by all of his prophets, every seer, saying, "Turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you by my servants the prophets." Nevertheless, they would not listen, but stiffened their necks like the necks of their fathers, who did not believe in the Lord their God. He says, every prophet, all of his prophets, every seer, he sent these men by the dozen. We get a record, in fact, during Elijah's time, of there apparently being some hundreds of prophets, all preaching the same thing. Turn. Quit doing this. Begin doing that which is right. I talked a few weeks ago about that frustrating part of parenthood and discipline where I believe I feel much like God does, loving my child, not wanting to have to do something that is going to harm my child, even for the moment, but knowing that that is what is right for them, committing to do that. And I find myself at times really kind of begging them to do what I've asked them to do so that I don't have to do something I don't want to have to do. Here is God saying to this nation, turn, please do it, please come back so that you don't have to be punished. That's why Israel's led into captivity. That's why that nation only lasts for 200 years, because they would not listen. But that fact, that reality, it implies, reveals that truth that had they done differently, had they turned, had they heard, had they kept his commandments, had they listened to his prophets, there would have been a different outcome. There is always that way of doing it differently. We refer to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 with some regularity. Chapter 10 and verse 13. God will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. But with all those temptations that are common to man, he makes the way of escape available. And this I find to be true going all the way back to nearly the very beginning. I think often of Cain in Genesis chapter 4. Angry at Abel, angry at God, angry at himself, angry at the world, I guess. Just sort of all around having a miserable experience because his unfaithful offering had been disrespected by God. His countenance fell, and the Lord comes to Cain and says, "Why are you angry, and why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you that it should have mastery over you." There are the two choices that are presented And from that time in Genesis chapter 4, they're the same two choices that end up being presented over and over and over again throughout the Old Testament and throughout the New Testament. And every time we come to that crossroads in our lives, still today, these thousands of years later, if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you don't do well, you know what is going to happen. You'll fall prey. You will be wrestled away from me. You will end up doing something foolish and irrevocable and something which is going to permanently put a stain perhaps on your soul. Don't twist yourself into something wicked and evil, Cain. Do well, do better, and you can be accepted. That offer that was available to him is available to each one still today. So long as we have the ability to be moved by our conscience, so long as we remain capable of being convicted of wickedness when we have been the transgressor, there remains a possibility of salvation. If you have the wherewithal to know that you have sinned, then you have the capacity to be forgiven of that sin. It is the same today as it was with those in Jeroboam's day and all who came after, where God sends his prophet, he sends his seer, and he says, turn, turn and live, turn and follow my commandments, turn and be blessed. He makes the same appeal today to each one. I hope that we can hear that voice in our ears, telling us of a gift that is ready, that is available to all who would come, whosoever will. This morning, if that describes you, you want what God has offered. You recognize that you have fallen astray. You have gone after maybe the sins of those who have come before you, maybe the sin that the world encourages, whatever it might be, you have strayed from the Lord. Turn, come back to him. The way is there. The way is available. The way has, at the end of that way, the loving Father who stands with arms spread, ready to come and embrace. And we stand ready to come and embrace any who would appeal to the Lord this morning. If you would like to do that, please come forward while we stand, while we sing this song.